Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session of today's call, you may press star followed by one to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to turn the call over to Christine Cosmos. You may begin.
Thank you, operator, and thank you everyone for joining the call today. This is Chris Cosmos. I'm the Director of the Division of State and Local Readiness here at CDC, and I'm also the lead of our State Coordination Task Force. What we want to do today is we're going to give you some follow-up information from the ZAP conference that we held in April here at CDC. This is the third in a series of six teleconferences that we have planned for you to follow up on specifically some of the feedback that you provided to us from the participants in the summit, as well as some of the information that we had from the evaluations that you really wanted to delve down into six specific topic areas to help continue your ZAP planning. So this is our third, and the focus today is on vector surveillance and vector control. I think, let me just foreshadow some of the upcoming ones. So our fourth session will be sexual transmission and pregnancy planning, which is on June 2nd. The fifth one is EPI, and that's on June 8th. And then our final one will be on diagnostics, lab capacity, and lab testing interpretation, which we know is an issue that people want to delve down into more. That's going to be on June 13th. So before we get started today, though, I would like to just continue something that we started at the ZAP Summit, which is to gather any of the success stories or challenges that you might have and how this is either helping your efforts or things that we can do better moving forward. So if you have any successes and or challenges that you would like to share with us, even if it's a couple of bullets, you could send us that information to preparedness@cdc.gov. So let me kind of tell you what you're going to hear today. We've got Dr. Janet McAllister here today. She is leading the vector team here at CDC and has been working on some of the CONUS vector strategies. We're going to talk about mosquito-based arbor surveillance. We're going to talk about steps to reduce Zika virus transmission by mosquitoes. She's going to talk about adult larval surveillance. She's going to talk about some of the adult mosquito trapping. And she's going to talk about Aedes aegypti mosquito in relation to Zika virus transmission. So rather than me stumbling through it, I'm going to give it over to Janet so that she can walk through it, and then we can have Q&A after that. So, Janet?
Okay. Thank you, Chris. So, the first slide is kind of an overview of the Zika response. And there's a lot of different parts to the Zika response. It involves entomologists, epidemiologists, of course, healthcare providers. But the entomologic response, because there's no vaccine, there's really no treatment, is one of the more important things that can be done to actually limit a human vector contact through mosquito control. So the next slide. So there are things that can be done before the mosquito season, and for a lot of the U.S., we're actually in mosquito season now, but at the ZAP Summit, we were asking states to prepare for mosquito season. So I apologize for those of you who are already dealing with mosquitoes that this is last month's news. But really getting states to develop some sort of plan for how they would respond if Zika virus occurred in their jurisdiction. And because most of the mosquito surveillance in the U.S. has been focused in recent years on Culex mosquitoes, there's a lot of lack of knowledge in the U.S. about where the vectors actually are or are not, what are some of the higher risk areas, and then also identifying resources that would be available for a state to use within the state. So what kind of mosquito control districts are in place, how well do they function, are they well enough in functioning that they could actually lend resources to another place that within the state that might not have good vector control. Also, what other resources outside of mosquito control districts might be able to be utilized to do Zika virus control, because Zika virus, the mosquito, is so different from Culex that a lot of the really good prevention, mosquito prevention techniques are very human resource oriented versus just getting in a truck and spraying a neighborhood. And so those kinds of planning things, you should be well along the way of accomplishing. Also, implementing education programs or having some sort of education and communications plan to get out to local jurisdictions for them to use to educate homeowners on things that they can do to protect themselves from Zika. So those are all really before planning, before the mosquito season. Now that we are in mosquito season, this is the time that you can actually start implementing some of those plans, such as because the mosquitoes are active, you can start doing vector surveys to find out what counties in your state do and do not have Aedes aegypti or Aedes albopictus, and estimate relative abundance of them. Now that mosquitoes are active and you can catch them, now's the time to do the insecticide resistance profile. So if you are going to be spraying, you would know what products might be the most effective ones to use. And then also, you can, you know, source reduction is key to controlling Aedes aegypti. And so plans on how you can do tire cleanups in an area, how are you going to address getting containers taken care of in yards. If there's a locally acquired case of Zika, how are you going to address the sanitation piece of it as well? So the next slide, I'm on the guidance to initiate vector control when cases are detected. CDC came up with a phased response on Zika. I'm not going to go through that because the first two slides I just covered really are phase zero, which is before the season, and phase one is mosquito season. What CDC is recommending is initiating control around all cases because, again, Zika is a mosquito-human-mosquito virus transmission cycle. There aren't other animals involved in it like there are with West Nile virus. And so we're going to see Zika virus. We are already seeing Zika virus in travel cases coming back to the U.S., but now that the mosquitoes are active, the risk of local mosquitoes becoming infected and starting a local nidus of transmission is much increased. And so looking at all cases, travel cases included, to try and prevent Zika virus from becoming locally established is our number one recommendation. We recommend a minimum of 150 meters around the case to be treated for mosquitoes, a good vector assessment, larvaciding, adulticiding, source reduction, the appropriate actions for the situation around that case. Also included focusing neighborhood education, door hangers, flyers, to let people know that they need to be cleaning up their backyards and cleaning out water-holding containers, and also just more general education for the community at large as well. So I'm going to go over some of the principles of mosquito arbovirus programs, really identifying and mapping where larval habitats are is the backbone, as well as monitoring adult activity. So knowing what species are present, what abundance they are present in, also doing infection rates, that's important for a lot of arbovirus surveillance programs, and I'll talk a little more specifically about Zika when it comes to infection rates in adults. So the next slide, the advantages of a mosquito-based program. If arbovirus surveillance is being done, especially if you are looking to sample for virus in mosquitoes, if it's done in the mosquito control districts, you get a really quick turnaround of adults, of results. Collecting adult mosquitoes does provide you with the community composition that is in place at a particular place at a particular time, but it also gives you some the baseline of historical data to evaluate risk going forward. So it's important to consider a mosquito-based arbovirus surveillance, but it's really going to be more important if local transmission occurs or if Zika virus were to become endemic in the U.S. In the absence of Zika virus, it's not so informative because the virus isn't there and it's a drain on resources to be testing for a virus that is known not to be in an area. There are some limitations, of course, on these programs. It may not be easily detectable, especially very early in the transmission season, or especially if you are having difficulty with getting enough mosquitoes to do sampling for virus. And also virus transmission, it varies regionally. And so whatever kind of program that might be developed going forward, you really need to consider how many traps and what traps and testing procedures are going to be used because Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus do not go to the traps that are currently used for the West Nile virus arbovirus surveillance system. So the next slide has a bunch of pictures on it. These are examples of common containers that might be found around homes where Zika virus transmitting mosquitoes could be. One of the ones that's most commonly overlooked are clogged rain gutters. Also the black corrugated pipe that people put on the bottom of their rain spouts. Will hold enough water to breed lots of Aedes mosquitoes. And they do also develop in tree holes and plants like bromeliads, which will hold water. And so there are natural sites as well as man-made sites that you will find these mosquitoes in. And CDC just put up a really nice method of filling tree holes that we've worked with arborists to develop. And so you don't put sand or cement or anything in the tree holes. You actually need to use expanding foam. So this is a case house in USBI, and if you look around the perimeter of the house, you see all of these buckets that are just sitting out. that's prime Aedes aegypti habitat, and shows you why it, because there was a case of Zika virus at this house, that's exactly why you need to be doing the sanitation along with the control. This next slide is a variety of surveillance tools for Aedes aegypti. Again, it's very hard to survey for this mosquito because they typically are not very abundant compared to what we're used to with Culex mosquitoes. Again, the otocidal gravid traps, the ovi trap, using various ways to aspirate mosquitoes so that you use basically a vacuum to go suck them up indoors, can also be used outdoors in vegetation. There's a lot of different ways to survey for them, and we really don't have time to go through all of the trapping techniques, but there are traps available that target Aedes aegypti. And it is important to do larval and pupae surveys, and so I'm going to spend a little bit of time on that because that is a common way to do surveillance for this species, particularly because it's so hard to catch the adults. So these are most widely used surveys. There's actually on the CDC website under the control of Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus page. There's a more complete description of what these different surveys are, what a house index is, what a Brito index, container indices, with some pros and cons of all of those. But there are a lot of different ways that a surveillance program could be set up, and these are some of the techniques that can be used to do that survey. Pupal surveys are actually thought to be a little more useful than larval surveys because there's a lot of mortality in the pupal stage or larval stage. So the numbers of pupae that you might find are actually more closely aligned to the numbers of adults that are soon to be in the environment. But they do rely on relatively large sample sizes to get reliable estimates of adult populations, and so they are incredibly labor-intensive. Some of the limitations is that they rely on visual inspections, and it's very easy to miss cryptic habitats, such as to find out if there are Aedes in water meters, you have to pull the lid off the water meter and look in there. You have to look in storm drains. You have to climb up and look in the gutters to find all of the cryptic habitats that might be breeding out there. Okay, I did not skip one. As far as adult surveillance, ovi traps, sticky ovi traps are one way to catch adult mosquitoes. The ovi traps as well, they don't really give you an idea of how many adults were there, but they do give you a good indication of adults are present because they are laying eggs. And then to actually identify the mosquitoes, you do have to hatch those eggs out, so they can be labor-intensive. But if you're just counting numbers of eggs per ovi trap or mosquitoes per trap, they're not invasive. It's just a little jar. They're very inexpensive, and they're very easily deployed, and they are kind of the backbone of surveillance for Aedes aegypti. The next slide just shows that there are mechanical aspirators, very labor intensive because you have to go in and really run that aspirator in the backs of closets and under furniture where the mosquitoes are. But it is a very effective way to sample for adult mosquitoes. There are also a variety of passive gravid sticky traps out there. They attract the adult mosquito in, and the adult mosquito becomes trapped. They do correlate well with traps that specifically sample adult mosquitoes, such as the BG Sentinel trap. And they may or may not have some sort of lure to them. So the next slide is the BG Sentinel trap. This is probably the most commonly used adult trap to catch live adult Aedes aegypti. These mosquitoes go through a fan and are captured into a container. And so if you're going to be doing virus isolation and you need the adults to be alive, this is a good trap to use. The black one has actually been shown to be a little more attractive to Aedes aegypti than the white version of it. So if you haven't purchased any of these yet, I would suggest you go with the version 2, which is the black version. And also, you can use it to trap different physiological stages. So host-seeking mosquitoes versus ovipositing mosquitoes. So the next slide, Aedes aegypti, kind of goes over just a little bit of the biology of it. This is a very, very urban mosquito. Lives in close proximity to mosquitoes, prefers to bite humans. It will bite during the day, although it will also bite at night. It has a very short flight range throughout its entire life cycle, usually not moving more than 50 meters in a single night. It feeds on multiple people during a single egg cycle, so it will bite, take a little bit of blood, and then move on to another host. It skip oviposits, so it does not lay all of its eggs in the same container, so it will spread its eggs out throughout the entire backyard because it's relying on that container to be flooded and for the water to stay in it long enough for the larvae to develop. So it's a strategy for the species to survive by spreading its eggs throughout the environment. So when you're counting eggs, it's very difficult in a single container to know that those eggs are from one female or from multiple females. And so that's why some of the surveillance is difficult for this species. And it's also difficult to control for a lot of those reasons. So this next slide is the virus transmission cycle, and I want to really focus on the epidemic cycle because that's what's going on in the Americas right now. Aedes aegypti, Aedes albopictus, potentially transmitting the virus from an infected host to a non-infected host. In Africa, the sylvatic cycle is known to exist. We don't know what is going to happen in the Americas. So surveillance, virus surveillance in mosquitoes, really shifting gears a little bit, not just surveying for the mosquitoes, but for the actual virus itself, is conducted to obtain evidence of local transmission, estimate infection rates, and to evaluate effectiveness of control measures, because when you're doing control to stop an epidemic, you want to be targeting those older females as much as possible, because those are the ones that are actually transmitting virus. And so if you go out and spray You may have a lot of mosquitoes that quickly rebound because they are emerging from larval habitat. That doesn't mean that you didn't have an effective control event. It means that the population rebounded, but those young mosquitoes are not yet infected, and so you can actually impact virus transmission, even though your surveillance may say that it looks like you still have a lot of mosquitoes around. So it's not efficient to conduct Zika virus surveillance necessarily outside of an outbreak, because mosquitoes typically have very low infection rates in nature, and Aedes aegypti is also found at very low mosquito density, so it takes a lot of work to find enough adult mosquitoes to do the testing. However, around cases, collecting those mosquitoes actually would increase your chances of finding infected mosquitoes in the environment. And again, if it's not endemic in an area, doing that kind of mosquito surveillance and virus testing is not really that productive. So just like with West Nile virus mosquitoes, if you do decide that you're going to incorporate virus testing of mosquitoes into your program, then it works pretty much the same way as it does with Culex, where you would identify the mosquitoes, you would sort them on a chill table, keeping a cold chain so that you could potentially isolate the virus from the mosquito later on, differentiate the sexes and the species into separate pools, and then storing them at -7 if you're not going to test them, -70 if you're not going to test them right away. So the specimen processing would actually be very similar to what you might already be doing with West Nile virus. And then this is just a picture of identifying the mosquitoes. The next slide is different laboratory screening that could be done. The real-time RT-PCR primers that could be used for human diagnostics would be the same primers that you can use to identify the virus in mosquitoes using PCR. The other way to do it is to grind the mosquitoes, put them into cell culture, and try to isolate the virus itself versus just identifying whether they were infected using the PCR. And again, that's very similar to what you might be doing with West Nile virus already. So why would you want to do that? Number one is we don't understand the infection rates in the vector populations for Zika virus in particular. And so getting some of that information can be very helpful for us going forward. There are some limitations, though, because some of the more complex calculations do require sample sizes that are relatively large, sample size dependent estimates. And so because this mosquito is not easy to catch in the adult stage, and it's not terribly abundant where it is found sometimes, getting enough material to isolate virus from it and do these calculations can be a limiting factor. But if you do have enough, then using the vector index, which again is something that most places are a lot of places use for West Nile virus, it would work the exact same way. You would have input of abundance of the mosquitoes. You would have input on infection rates. And then you could come up with an index that you could use as a relative risk for doing vector control. So arboviral surveillance programs, they need to be simple, economical, effective, and sustainable seas. And again, with Zika virus, and because it's not endemic, this is one place where you really might need to spend a bit of time deciding, are you going to use the resources for an arbovirus surveillance program versus are you going to use the resources to just do surveillance and control? And we don't have a prescriptive answer that we want everybody to do it. I think in the long run, once Zika virus is identified, especially to be locally transmitted in an area, that it is something you want to be able to potentially mobilize quickly to get some of that vector infection rate information for yourself. So because there's no vaccine, there's really no cure, the life cycle of the mosquito is very important to understand. And when it comes to mosquito control, we can target the adults, we can target the immatures, and the immatures are really the aquatic stage of the mosquito. Is one particular area that does not necessarily take a lot of high-tech know-how to do, especially if you're using sanitation as your primary means of control, because if they don't have a place for the larval stage to occur, you're not going to get lots of adults. But both of those stages can be targeted, particularly the larvae, to some extent the eggs, and the adults. We do not have, outside of oils, any products that really are good pupicides. So once that mosquito is in the pupal phase, if you don't dump the water out and kill it that way, then using oils is really one of the only ways to kill lots of pupae. So the strategies for vector control, again, targeting those immature stages. You can use oviposition traps, sticky traps. You can use larvicides in places that cannot be cleaned up or cannot be screened off. So source reduction, I have it listed there. A lot of people think of it as cleaning up the trash and the containers, but you can also reduce the source of larval development by screening containers. So if, you know, people are using rain barrels in your area, making sure you are targeting those people with education to make sure the rain barrel is sealed to reduce that as a source of breeding, or that has good screening on it. As well, targeting adult mosquitoes, the techniques for doing that are really generally the same as what you would be doing for Culex and other mosquitoes, using handheld or truck-mounted or even airplane-mounted spraying equipment. The real difference with Zika virus is the concept of doing indoor or outdoor residual spraying. And we are suggesting that these types of spraying be targeted to where mosquitoes actually are. So if you look at the picture of the man looking behind the couch, that's where the mosquitoes are resting. They're resting in those dark, quiet, protected areas within the house. So you don't need to be spraying the entire wall. You need to be just doing a spot treatment. And the same for outside as well. The mosquitoes are resting behind the barbecue pit, you know, under the barbecue pit cover, under the lawn furniture, under the junk on the carport. And so if you're doing residual spraying, those are the places to target putting that spray down. We are not suggesting that you go do indoor residual spraying at every house 150 meters around a case house. We are suggesting indoor residual spraying as an option only in places where the housing is open, where they don't have screens, where they don't have air conditioning. And then it would be something that the homeowner, of course, would have to let you come in to do. So we're not telling people go out and do that as a routine activity around all cases. It is a special instance. It's a control technique that is on the table. There are two insecticides that are available for that use for spot treatments indoors targeting adult mosquitoes that are available on the market. Most mosquito control may not be familiar with them because they're usually used by pest control companies to do spot treatments indoors for other insects as well. Aerial spraying, again, it's a tool that is on the table. We're not telling people if they have a local case of transmission or travel-related cases to bring out the aircraft. We're telling people to treat around the cases in a smaller area. However, if you have multiple instances of transmission over a wide area, then the most efficient way to treat that wide area may be by using aircraft or maybe by using trucks.
So some important considerations when you are looking at what kinds of control activities that you would use around Zika virus cases. One of them is insecticide resistance. I mentioned that early on. Before there are even cases, if you can collect mosquitoes and test them, that is a good thing because you will know what products would be most effective against your local Aedes aegypti populations ahead of time. There are also a lot of sociocultural factors you have to take into consideration when you are building your plan and pre-position communications and maybe even be doing education and outreach now because there are a lot of people who object to insecticide uses or a particular application method. Even though it's the exact same product coming out of the aircraft as what is sprayed on the ground from a truck, because it came out of an aircraft, all of a sudden it's more toxic and going to, you know, kill everything in the environment in the minds of some people, whereas they'll call and complain when they don't see the truck. And so those kinds of considerations need to be thought of ahead of time, especially in places that don't normally have mosquito control or a particular application method occurring. And then there are also concerns about organophosphate insecticides in particular. A lot of pyrethroids are used currently, and because of that, there is widespread insecticide resistance to pyrethroids. It's not everywhere. And even within a single city, it may just be in one neighborhood of that city, but when you are considering switching back to an organophosphate, if you start mentioning the word malathione, it gets back to those objections to insecticides, and even though it's a safe, effective product, doesn't mean that your population is going to buy into it just because of the name recognition. And then there are the legal issues that, again, need to be worked out from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
what HIPAA, have you talked to your state lawyers and legal experts on how you're going to be able to report cases of Zika to local vector control or local cities that do mosquito control? Are you going to be able to report out an exact address, or are you going to have to work within a 100 block because of HIPAA issues? And then there's because of those privacy issues. And then the other part of the legal issues is what recourse do you have to go in and ask people to clean up or to allow access to property if you're going to be doing individual property treatments. And those are really sticky sticky questions that if you have not completely thought through or gotten some clarity on it, there's a little bit of urgency now that mosquito control season is here to at least have considered those so you will know how you're going to respond, because once that first local acquired case hits, if it hits in your state and your jurisdiction, that's not the time to be wrangling with are you going to be allowed onto to properties, or you know, what kind of code enforcement is in place to allow you to demand that people clean up properties around that transmission. So this last slide again is some source material that went into this presentation. This is all available on the CDC website. Goes into a little bit more detail of what I covered here, and then I have to thank John Paul Mutebi, who was originally going to give this presentation, for these pictures. He grew up not far from the Zika Forest, and this tower is still there. So if you ever visit the Zika Forest, you can climb the tower and look out over the forest. And I would draw your attention to the spelling of Zika.
What is the Zika Forest?
So there was a question here about what is the Zika Forest. Zika is the name of the forest, and that's where the virus was first isolated. They were doing a yellow fever project, and they were putting monkeys out and then testing them for whatever viruses and collecting mosquitoes as well. And that's how they discovered the Zika virus.
All right. So thank you, Janet. That was very thorough, great information. I think in terms of some of the nuts and bolts, Janet and her team are working on a final draft of a continental U.S. and Hawaii vector surveillance and control plan that is almost finished, and once it is, we will send that out through our usual distribution channels, but it'll give you some kind of specific information on and recommendations from CDC on vector surveillance and vector control. So, operator, could we open it up for questions?
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one. You will be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your request, you may press star 2. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. And one moment, please, for our first question.
So I think, operator, while we're waiting for that, we have a couple that came in through the mailbox. Janet, do you want to tackle some of them?
So the first question, should I read out who it's from?
No.
Okay. The first question was, there has not been any dengue or widespread chikungunya virus transmission in the contiguous U.S. So what is the evidence to suggest there would be any sustained transmission of Zika? And if so, where does CDC anticipate this to affect the most? There have been sporadic local transmission events of both of those viruses in southern Florida, along the Texas border, in Hawaii, and we are also concerned about the border with Mexico along Arizona and California as well. So we're hoping that we don't get sustained transmission occurring. We would also hope that it does not become endemic in the United States, but we don't have a crystal ball. This is a new virus. This virus is doing things that we did not expect it to do, particularly being sexually transmitted. That's a new wrinkle, which makes it different from chikungunya, makes it different from dengue. And so we can't rule out that it may not become endemic in the U.S. Where it's also being introduced to places where the mosquitoes have never seen it, so we don't know for sure what it will do in the U.S., and so we certainly need to be prepared to deal with it and to try and prevent it from becoming endemic, or to prevent local transmission, sustained local transmission from establishing.
We do have questions on the
Let's so take a question from the phone.
Thank you. We do have a question from Susan Johnson. Your line is open. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. On the slide that talks about Aedes aegypti, a particularly dangerous vector, it says it has a short flight range, typically 200 meters. But when you were talking, you said the flight range was 50 meters. So which is it?
50 meters or less in a single night, but over the lifetime of the mosquito, it can move much further. And so our recommendation for treating 150 meters around a house is based on the movement that we might expect to see in a in the lifetime of that adult mosquito.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We do have a question from Rachel Seven. Your line is open. Go ahead with your question.
Hello, it's Rachel Seven, Los Angeles County. I have a question. One of the things you alluded, but there wasn't a specific slide, was on legal issues, which I think could be really challenging to make people clean up their property. Are you going to do a follow-up on this with some more detailed suggestions or references? We could get our county council involved. Is that the type of recommendation that you would recommend?
Hello, this is Chris from CDC. I'm sorry, I think we momentarily disconnected ourselves. Operator, are you still with us?
Yes, we are. Thank you.
Okay, sorry about that. So we were discussing legal issues before we disconnected ourselves. So, Janet, can you discuss legal issues?
Yeah, so there are a lot of layers to legal issues around property access, and it varies greatly from state to state. There are state laws, there are county laws, there are federal laws. There are local ordinances. There are sanitation codes that have to be considered, and it can be very thorny navigating through all that. And it can again, if you're a home rule state, those what you can do from the state level may be very different than if you're not a home rule state. And so you know, the suggestions that I have is that you go to, if you're a vector control district, you talk to your city or your county lawyers and ask them what it is locally that they suggest you can do. There, I know different jurisdictions have worked out different processes. Some of them, they have to get a warrant to be able to enter a property. Others can rather easily write citations under sanitary codes to if people are not going to comply with cleaning up. So those are just a couple examples of what could be done in different places. And
I think it's just best to know your own legal authorities.
You got to know your own legal authorities. That's exactly right.
All right. Operator, could we have the next question, please?
Yes. Our next question comes from Haley. Your line is open. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks. This is Haley Aglin from Arizona Department of Health. Thanks, as always, Janet, for your great presentation. I just thought I would mention this as a follow-up to my email, but maybe it would be helpful for other partners. I know that there's been conversations with CDC internally about a scope of work for vector control contracts. So, you know, in Arizona, we have 15 counties, not as many as other states, of course, and many of those counties have capacity to do a lot of vector control work and surveillance, and some of our smaller counties just don't have those resources. So in Arizona, we're interested in getting and potentially looking into a contract with a vector control agency that can come in the idea for an emergency response where we really had to do high levels of abatement and what that scope of work would look like. So I'm wondering if you have that already established at CDC. We have heard that you have, and if that is available, some type of scope of work or how we would describe that contract, if that could be shared with us. Maybe not now if it's a lengthy explanation, but if there is that information that can be shared online or emailed out to partners would be very greatly appreciated.
I'm not sure. So we're just debating. So in general, we do here at CDC, we are pursuing a contract for emergency vector control within the continental U.S. and Hawaii. But we just need to be really clear about the fact that that is Plan C of a vector control program. So we're counting on states and locals utilizing their own resources. This is not a primary mechanism for funding vector control at the state and local level. So we're going to rely on state and locals to do their vector control and their vector surveillance as they typically do. There's funding that has or that will be awarded to state and locals through the ELC cooperative agreement and also to a lesser extent for vector, the preparedness cooperative agreement. So that is your second line of defense for augmenting your vector surveillance and vector control. So we're counting on the states using that federal funding that's coming through you or coming to you through those two cooperative agreements to augment any state or local contracts that you already have or develop ones where you know that there are gap areas. When those fail or your resources are stripped, then we do have a contract that we're pursuing here at CDC for emergency vector surveillance or vector control that we will be able to deploy rapidly once your resources have been exhausted. But again, it really is a fallback mechanism once your own resources have been exhausted.
I think for your question, what we put into that scope of work for that contract CDC developed, I'm not a contract specialist, so I'm not sure.
Looking for the scope of it?
Yeah, what we can share out and what we can't.
We'd have to talk to our contract people.
Ask our contract people. But if we can share it, then we certainly can.
Sure. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. That's very helpful. That was exactly what I was looking for. But thanks, Chris, for that extra explanation. All of that you just shared is something that Arizona is aware of. And we do, of course, plan to utilize our resources first, but we're curious about that scope of work. So I would appreciate that follow-up. Thank you.
Sure, we'll look into it. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dr. Gerald Hensley. Your line is open. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, good afternoon. Dr. Hensley in South Carolina. I was inquiring whether CDC has prepared a formalized package which could be distributed for presentations to various community groups, or are they contemplating doing anything like that, or is this going to be relegated to the state and local agencies?
Do you mean PowerPoint presentations like a Zika 101 type presentation that could be used locally?
Yes, or something along those lines that would be applicable to the general public.
Yeah, I think that if you looked on the CDC Zika website, there are lots of resources there. There is, I know there is a Zika 101. There's a number of different other resources for communities and healthcare workers and state and local public health. So I would encourage you to look there for resources. There's also a lot of resources from the ZAP Summit that
right.
I think are posted there as well.
As well as all of the slides from the ZAP Summit.
Right.
So,
and if there's something missing that that's not there that you feel like you would need, I would encourage you to send us an email or anything that you need at the state and local level, preparedness@cdc.gov, and then we can triage those to the appropriate team and get some answers.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So there were two quick questions that came in. One was, what type of screens can people use on rain water containers? And any type of screening that is, the opening is small enough to exclude mosquitoes, so it would be the same type of screening that you might use on your house, on your windows. There's fiberglass screen, so it's flexible and bendable that you could put over the top of a barrel and you know, put in place with a bungee cord or something. But you just, any kind of screen could be used. It's just a matter of the hole being small enough that a mosquito cannot get through it.
And you can Google that. I've done that. You can Google that and find the size of the screen that's appropriate for keeping out mosquitoes.
And so another quick question was, has Fort Collins CDC considered or initiated vector competency studies with Zika and other domestic U.S. species? There's actually a wide group of people who are doing that in the U.S. Fort Collins is doing some of it. We have been coordinating with Colorado State University, with University of Texas, Galveston, with University of California, Davis, so that we're not all doing the same species and the same mosquitoes. But there is a lot of groups that are doing vector competency studies as we speak with Zika virus, and some of them on other species besides Aegypti and Albopictus.
I have one other question that came in about resources that CDC may be able to deploy if there is local transmission, and just want to let people know that we have developed a team that I think some of you will be very familiar with from the Ebola days called the CERT team, and that is a group of CDC experts that can be deployed at the state's request if there is local transmission within your community, and that's a multidisciplinary team populated with entomologists and risk communicators, epidemiologists that can be deployed to help assist you with your response to local transmission. Operator, are there any other questions? I know our time is running out. Actually, we're beyond time, but are there any other questions in queue?
We do have three questions in queue. Would you like to take the next one?
Sure.
Thank you. And that comes from David Chang. Your line is open. Go ahead with your question.
This is sort of related to vector competency. What about animal hosts that might maintain the sylvatic cycle, perhaps in the United States, California, and what is maintaining the sylvatic cycle in Africa?
So the sylvatic cycle is maintained in non-human primates, and I know in Brazil they have isolated virus from some of the non-human primates in Brazil, but really that's they haven't really found it in anything outside of primates.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. We just have one question left, and that comes from Paul Edestad. Your line is open. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. Hi, it's Paul Edestad in New Mexico. We, too, have been working on our ELC grant, putting in funding there for local mosquito control programs. My issue with this is that I think there are some unreasonable expectations of how much money each of these local mosquito control programs may be getting. Some of us have dozens of counties and municipal local mosquito control programs who are within the range of Aedes aegypti or albopictus. And there are some national associations who are putting out, telling these local programs that they should be asking for money for vehicles and all kinds of other things. And once you start taking this funding and splitting it up between all these different groups, I mean, it really doesn't leave that much for each of them to get. And so I think there are some unreasonable expectations being put out there about what they can expect to get.
I think you know, the whole issue of vehicles, et cetera, kind of, I don't know, is a red herring.
I think that it's up to the individual states, because it's the state that's applying for the ELC and the FEP grant to decide on what the rules are going to be within that state. So traditionally, ELC money has not been used for mosquito control. It's been used strictly for surveillance. This is the first time. And so statements that it could be used for to buy a truck or it could be used to buy some chemical does not mean that that's what it in a particular state it needs to be used for. Each state has to evaluate what the needs are for the state, what the needs are for the local mosquito control. If you have districts that are well-funded, should they necessarily be getting this money? Maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe it needs to be going to the programs that are not well-funded, to be able to buy them traps so they can start doing surveillance and start doing a better job at mosquito control. So, again, it's up to the states to decide how that money might be used within the state and what the rules for mosquito control money are going to be.
Okay, and I guess my request is for CDC to please talk to some of these national associations who are campaigning almost and putting out messages to all their memberships to be asking for this money, and there's all kinds of money available, and maybe tell them to tone it down or you know, I'm not sure where they're getting these messages and why they're putting them out the way they are.
Right. No, point very well taken. I think we've heard the same thing, and I would just underscore what Janet said, that a reasonable state approach based on risk and better understanding where the gaps are is really the best strategy. So, but point very well taken. Thank you. Okay, I think at this point, Janet, we will wrap it up for today. Operator, was there one more thing or one more question that made it into the queue? Or
at this time, I'm showing no further questions.
Okay, great. All right, well, thank you, everybody, for joining today's call. Hopefully it's been very helpful. Thank you, Janet, for an excellent presentation. Again, the CONUS or the vector control strategy will be out, and we will send that out through our usual distribution chain. So a lot of this information that Janet covered will be included in that domestic strategy. So with that, I just want to remind you again of the upcoming series, so please watch your emails for that. And if you have any questions or anything that needs further clarification, please send it to the email box at preparedness@cdc.gov. Thank you, everybody, and thank you for dialing in.
Thank you, and this does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. At this time, you may disconnect your lines.